Welcome to Thinking Too Hard About Anime, an episode-by-episode discussion of a beloved animated series. It's a little bit of history, a little bit of analysis, and a lot of over-examining the Japanese cartoons we love so much. I am your co-host, Aaron J. Shelton, and with me, as always, is...
Noah Card.
And we are continuing our journey through Cowboy Bebop. I think, yeah, we're on disc 3, so we're two-thirds of the way through. And we are on session 19, Wild Horses. The synopsis for this episode is that while Jet and Faye are trying to capture some space pirates, Spike is visiting his old friend Doohan for an overhaul of the swordfish. Because the pirates are able to infect the cruise ships with a computer virus, effectively taking control of them, Spike is forced to take down the bounty without the help of the swordfish's computer system. And then towards the end, Doohan comes to the rescue of Spike in a 100-year-old spaceship.
So this episode was directed by Hirokazu Yamada and written by Akihiko Inari. And the title comes from the song of the same name by the Rolling Stones off of their 71 album, Sticky Fingers.
I have a little footnote involving Wild Horses. Okay. And I only know this because of where I was raised. It's widely accepted, although I think uncredited within the liner notes, that Wild Horses is co-written by Graham Parsons, who, if you are really into country music and early rock, you know who that is. He was part of the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers. But he is a native of my hometown, Waycross, Georgia.
Oh.
And to the point where not this year, thankfully, they didn't do this, but every year they have what's called the Graham Parsons Guitar Pool, which is just this like 2-day celebration.
Oh, that's really neat.
Yeah. I was like, oh, you can't be from Waycross and hear someone talk about Wild Horses and not have to bring that up. It's almost required.
Thoughts on the episode? What did you think?
So kind of on the surface, it can feel like this very tropey episode, especially within the sci-fi genre of, well, we got to do an episode where like all the technology is taken out or the characters have to rely on like their wits or their own knowledge to survive a situation.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like that. I can't think of anything specifically. Like Star Trek definitely did those kind of episodes, which has a connection to this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I think really what it is that it is this almost love letter to space travel and sort of pulling back the mundaneness of space travel within the show. And like, no, it's hard. It's super hard and impressive that we're in space.
Yeah, like this mono system makes all the space travel like pretty easy for everybody, but the moment that thing gets taken out, it becomes this like nightmarish like task to undertake. So this episode, I think when I first watched the series, it didn't really stand out to me, and I think coming back to it now, I actually like this episode a lot more than I think I did. Just like the whole like space travel, the kind of the crazy undertaking that the crew goes into when they try and track down these bounty heads. I find it a lot more enjoyable now for some reason. There's just something about it. I think I just appreciate it a little bit more.
I agree with you, but in a different way. I think the episode is a little sloppy and it feels like it's a lot of excuses to get to like the end.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked how, for me, this episode gave me a lot of nostalgia in researching for the podcast episode, especially because it's like, oh yeah, I was really into space as a kid.
Oh yeah.
Man, I'm a little older than you. So, but like, I think in our age range, every kid wanted to be an astronaut, right?
Yeah, at some point, yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah.
I definitely don't think that happens now. But yeah,
I really think just because of the space shuttle program being like such a thing of like the 80s and 90s, it really like, yeah, there's just something about the sort of zeitgeist around those vehicles and the things that were going on up there that really kind of grabbed every little kid's attention.
I was fortunate enough, just because of where we lived and because I was in the gifted program, you know, that thing that really helped.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go to the Kennedy Space Center for a field trip in elementary school.
Nice.
And it ruled. It ruled so hard. They put me in like a fake, I think it's called the MMU, a manned maneuvering unit. And they're just showing you like, hey, since there's no up and down in space, you have to, you know, here are things you mm-hmm. have to learn. It's like, make sure you pull these sequences in order, but be careful, you're upside down. So, you know, left is right and vice versa.
Right.
It was just, space ruled. It was, mm-hmm. it is cool. Space rules, and it did rule.
Yeah. I was ridiculously young, but I know we went, my family went to, like, you know, Disney World and Universal Studios, and I know we stopped at, I think it was the Kennedy Space Center. Like, it's been, like, I barely remember it at this point, but I remember being in a place in Florida that had big old rockets.
If you went to Disney and Universal, I believe the Space Center is on Cape Canaveral or right next to it. So it's, you know, it's just a wee bit east of Orlando.
Okay.
So that's probably where you were.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I just remember, like I said, I remember being in a place and there were big ass rockets all around me and it was cool as hell.
Every big prize on like a Double Dare
mm-hmm.
or What Would You Do was like, you're going to space camp.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a thing. It has become almost a joke at this point. It's just space camp is the like game show prize mm-hmm. in a way.
And you were happy, but you were happy of it. You were ecstatic.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But yeah, I will, like, if nothing else, this episode was like, and I think that's why I call it a love letter, because it is just, yes, we're using the science fiction as a backdrop and sort of a way to get different plot elements into the show. But it's the show recognizing where the fiction
mm-hmm.
came from, and like sort of honoring the past that might potentially get us there, which I don't think too many other science fiction shows do.
Yeah, I think like the only one that really kind of stands out to me is probably like Star Trek, where it's very much about space exploration and the history of that continuing into the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's some series like Enterprise. The opening credits has like the progress from flight on Earth to space travel to the In the show's context, the historical, like, first warp travel and things like that to the point of the current day in the show. And it's, yeah, that's the only other kind of series that really jumps to mind that really looks back at humanity's accomplishments getting off of the planet.
Speaking of Star Trek, there are a few different references. The mechanic and, I guess, the creator of the swordfish is Doohan, who is named after actor James Doohan, who played Scotty, the chief engineer on the USS Enterprise in the original Star Trek. Although Doohan visually is inspired by director Nicholas Ray, who was the director of Rebel Without a Cause. And then Miles, I wasn't so sure. I thought this was a bit of a stretch. But Miles, Doohan's assistant, is supposedly based on Geordi LaForge from Star Trek The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I mean, without the visor, it's like, is he? And I'm like, that makes sense because he's the assistant, you know.
Yeah, I can definitely see that being a thing. It's just, it's a little difficult to make quite the same connection because when I saw the information that like Nicholas Ray was like the visual inspiration, I went and looked up who he was. Because I wasn't sure. And like I saw a picture of him much older with like an eye patch. I'm like, yeah, that's totally him. And then like looking a little bit into his, you know, his history being another big influence in French New Wave, and that's something that we've definitely talked about a lot on the show. I can definitely see that being 100% true. The Geordi connection, I am not as certain about.
Unconfirmed, I would say.
Yeah.
Because they don't even like, they call him Miles. Like, if any, I honestly, you can make the argument that it's just a Sonic the Hedgehog reference.
That too, yeah. Miles and, per hour.
Or a Streets of Rage 2.
Yes.
Oh, he, hold on, what's his name? His name is not Eddie Skate Hunter. I don't believe you that his nickname is Skate. But like, yeah, Geordi LaForge is a stretch. But yeah, a bunch of Star Trek references, just space references in general. They actually, the space shuttle they take up is the Columbia, which if you've heard that name, it's probably, unfortunately, due to it coming apart on reentry on a February 1st, 2003, which was 2 years after this episode aired in the States.
Yep. I do remember that this episode actually got pulled out of the rotation for a while after the Columbia disaster. I mean, obviously, just because of that, they want to give it some breathing room before they start playing it again. I do remember that.
I was on in 03, I was on my mission, my Mormon mission. So we weren't like allowed to look at news. We weren't allowed to look at a lot of things, and news was definitely one of them. So I unfortunately like don't have a strong memory of the Columbia incident.
I remember it happening. Let's see, 2003. I would have been carry the two. I would have been like 15, 16 at the time. I'm trying to remember if I actually saw it, because it happened over the Atlantic, I think.
Oh, was there concern in your area?
Because I lived in coastal North Carolina at the time, and I'm just trying to remember if my memory is real or not.
As discussed previously on the show, maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that is probably not true then. I think that happened over the continental. Yeah, no, that is not it. I think I am thinking of something else. But yes, I do remember it happening at the time. Yeah, like I think, see, I guess it's just not quite as, I mean, it's obviously a very horrible, devastating thing to happen, but I don't think it is quite as well remembered as the Challenger disaster.
The Challenger had more marketing behind it, because again, it was during that time period.
Yeah, it was that, and like it happened like during liftoff, like it was a much more visual disaster. The Columbia just kind of broke up during reentry, which it's way, way up there. It's a lot harder to see. It's a lot harder to kind of understand what's going on when compared to the Challenger.
On top of that, it had Chris McAuliffe on board, which I think that's the name that people mainly remember because she was the first school teacher to go into space. And yeah, it was this huge, huge marketing behind it. And yeah, that's getting depressed.
Yeah.
We've danced around it, and I have a little bit of information on the shuttle program.
Okay.
For NASA. Again, especially in the 80s, huge, huge resurgence and interest in space here in the United States. I don't know if it rivaled what happened in the 60s with the space race between Russia and trying to get to the moon, but it very close, I think. So the shuttle program actually ran from 1972 to 2011, and the main focus of the program was to do more routine missions in space flights using a reusable spacecraft. All the other ones, all the other like capsules and everything were one and done. The mechanics of it were that the shuttle, which was very much shaped like a plane, as we see in the episode, basically three big ass rockets had to get slapped underneath that would take it into orbit around Earth. They would do whatever mission they needed to get back. And then the shuttle, when it came back into Earth, would glide back like a paper airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It is the only winged crew spacecraft to have achieved orbit and landing. And it's the only reusable crewed space vehicle that has ever made multiple flights into orbit. It's, again, just the, when we talk about these things, I feel like I have to stress, like, okay, you're an astronaut. You're in essentially a glider, one of those like balsa wood gliders,
mm-hmm.
strapped to three different 2 liter, you know, 3 2-liters with like Mentos and Diet Pepsi in it to shoot you into space. And then when you come back down, it's like, I don't know, glide. You have no power once you come back into Earth. Massively impressive. A lot of the missions that the shuttle crew did involved helping to bring segments of the ISS into orbit, crew rotation for the ISS. They launched and also serviced the Hubble telescope, along with recovering satellites and different payloads. Although the program started in 1971, that's all like development, testing. The first actual launch of a space shuttle was not until 1981 with the Columbia, actually.
Yep.
We talked about the Challenger and the Columbia disasters, which is, it's horrible, but I think still impressive the fact that there were 135 missions and these were the only, it could have been worse.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been way worse. We discussed the Challenger. It was lost 73 seconds after liftoff on January 28th of 1986. And the Columbia was lost 16 minutes before its expected landing on February 1st, 2003. And we've actually gained some more information about the Columbia, which is harrowing, honestly. It is secondhand, it's secondhand information, so you can't confirm it, but it's from a reputable source. We'll let you be the judge, I guess. But I have to say, like, it's not a direct quote. So what they learned is that the Columbia was lost in reentry because one of the heat shields on the wings was damaged. 10 years later, the shuttle project manager Wayne Hale wrote about this, and he was still he. And this was said by John Halpert, NASA's then director of mission operations. And this is supposedly what John Halpert said when the Columbia was in orbit during that mission. He supposedly said, "You know, there is nothing we can do about damage to the thermal protection system. If it has been damaged, it's probably better not to know. I think the crew would rather not know. Don't you think it would be better for them to have a happy, successful flight and die unexpectedly during entry than to stay on orbit, knowing that there was nothing to be done until the air ran out?" So supposedly, they knew, determined there was nothing to they could do to fix it, and allowed it to happen. Supposedly.
Wow.
Yeah, I also did not know this until going into this episode and during their research, which is, god damn, space is, one, if big if true.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I don't mean to make light of it, but it's, again, like the episode tries to remind us, like, space travel is super hard and difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so many things can go wrong, and we can't take that for granted, you know?
Yeah.
After each of these disasters, NASA, you know, there's investigations, there are changes that need to be made. You know, more safety is put into place for space travel. At the end of the day, to me, NASA is an important program within the United States. It's given us so many innovations, and mm-hmm. we can learn so much about it. NASA's budget for the fiscal year of 2020 is $22.629 billion. Now, that billion with a B.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sounds insane, right? That's, good Lord, that's so mm-hmm. much money. But that is only 0.48% of all U.S. government spending for 2020.
Yeah.
It's a program that is absolutely worth having around.
100%. I definitely agree with you there in... is definitely a program that needs, I would think, at least needs more funding.
Just a little bit more.
And maybe some reduction in funding some other places, but that's just me.
That's also just me.
Yeah.
But no, I don't know if you had anything. I know you had said you'd looked up some stuff on the shuttle program. I don't know if you had anything else.
Yeah, so, I mean, there was the five original shuttles. There was the Enterprise, the Columbia, the Challenger, Discovery, and Atlantis, with a sixth shuttle being added after the Challenger disaster called the Endeavor. The Enterprise was actually not a completely functional shuttle. It was effectively the prototype and the one that they used to test the flight capabilities of the shuttle. So they would take it up on a 747 and basically, again, throw it like a paper airplane to watch it glide and make sure the thing would work properly. After it ran its course of testing and things like that, it would eventually be disassembled, or at least partially, and retired. The Endeavor, like I said, was a replacement for the Challenger after the disaster in 1986. And it was largely built out of leftover parts. Yeah, so it was built mainly out of like spare parts, replacement pieces, things like that. They had enough components of other space shuttles laying around that they could make an entirely new one. And then after the Columbia disaster in 2003, they did not replace it because I think they kind of knew at the time that they were ramping down the missions to eventually end in July 21st of 2011 with the final Atlantis shuttle flight. And that's about all I really got for the American space shuttle program. But I will say that we are not the only country that attempted to have effectively a space plane. There was in 1988 a similar program by the Russians, the Soviet Union, called Buran. At least I believe that is how it is said, which means snowstorm or blizzard. And they effectively built a... It is uncanny how almost exactly like the American space shuttle this device looks. It has the same basic shape, the same basic color scheme.
Huh.
Yeah.
It sure even the booster rockets.
Mm-hmm. It is uncanny. I guess you know, you kind of come up with that delta wing design and you kind of stick with it. But there was only one unmanned orbital flight that was mainly there to test the rocket system. And then after that, the Soviet Union got dissolved. So they just kind of rolled the few shuttles that they had built into some hangars in Kazakhstan and just kind of left them there to rot. If you go on to Google or YouTube and look up, Russian space shuttle abandoned, you will get some videos of what is probably not legal activity of some urban explorers going out to these hangars in Kazakhstan and like spending time out there getting footage of the hangar and the shuttles. They're just left out there to rot, basically. But it is utterly fascinating to see these things. You'll get some good footage of them crawling around the hangar, climbing onto the space shuttles, and like going inside and looking around. And it is it feels like somebody's about to get murdered by a space alien at any time.
Yeah, if any are hiding out, it's definitely there.
Yeah, it has real big aliens kind of energy. But I highly recommend checking out that video. It is great. It is baffling how much this thing just looks like the American space shuttle.
I mean, when you get it right, I guess.
I guess, yeah.
they had to have tried, you know, they had to have tested so many designs. They were, it took them 10 years before they got into orbit.
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, again, I am just hit with, I don't even know if nostalgia is the right word for it. Because it's just remembering, actually, isn't that, wait, I'm literally describing nostalgia. the memory of feelings for a bygone era. But like, I remember being at the Kennedy Center and then like, and learning that like, oh yeah, air has mass. And if you go through it really fast, friction is caused.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's matter hitting up against matter. And that's why we have these big ass heat shields on the nose and bottom of the space shuttle. And like, I remember them demonstrating it with like a butane torch. And like, she just like fried it for like a minute. And then like, okay, touch it. Or touch the other side. It's like, oh, it's not even hot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which makes me think, like, why doesn't the Bebop? Shouldn't every ship that can, like, go in and out of planets have those shields?
Yeah, because, I mean, we see in one episode, we see the Bebop, like, entering atmosphere, and it gets, like, the plasma around the edges of the ship as it hits the atmosphere, but we don't ever really see any sort of shielding or anything like that. I guess I'm assuming that most of the vehicles in Cowboy Bebop have some sort of like space age material that they're made out of, or not space age, that'd be like 40 years ago. Some like super futuristic material that they're made out of that is just super heat resistant and doesn't need to be replaced. It's not a disposable thing. It's constantly reusable because we never see like any of the vehicles like, you know, get repaired for like heat damage outside of like maybe one or two scenes. Like, I'm sure the Swordfish is gonna have to see some repairs at the end of the episode once it's back in atmosphere. But
because remind me if like the Swordfish or the Red Tail, but yeah, those can go in and out of atmosphere, right? They've done it, yes. So it, yeah, I think it's just they're just a different material.
Yeah.
And or a wizard did it.
Yeah. Because, I mean, at the start of the episode, we see Spike basically crash landed on Earth. But, yeah, he had to have gotten there somehow. So, yeah, I don't think they handle it nearly as well as, like, the Bebop could. But they are definitely capable of entering the atmosphere when they have, you know, fuel and full control and everything. Mm-hmm. Spike, at the end of the episode, is kind of SOL when it comes to having his monosystem and fuel and things like that. So he's just kind of having to wing it.
That's because towards the end, they don't really catch the bounty, and we're kind of left. It's kind of unresolved what happens to the pirates, because I think the last thing is like, we're out of fuel and we're falling, and then, well, we'll ignore them. They're going to fall to their death.
They totally explode.
Did I miss that?
That's when
I watched this twice.
They explode and Spike moves himself into the way of the Bebop to protect him from getting hit by more of the viruses.
What was I doing?
I don't know. Can't tell you. But
that's big. Why did I swear I watched it twice.
There is totally a big ass explosion, and then you see more of like the virus anchors come flying out of it.
I remember
because the Bebop is overhead, and Spike makes the comment that it looks like a beautiful goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ship explodes, and Spike has to move himself into the path of the virus anchors, harpoons, whatever you want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, that's what kind of dooms him to get dragged into the atmosphere.
Because the Bebop has to basically disengage.
Yeah, it has to disengage. And then Spike has his little, hey, there's some whiskey behind the fridge moment, which I thought was a nice touch.
Again, I go back to my previous statement of, I think this is a sloppy episode.
Mm.
Towards the end, a lot of things are going on. And there are a lot of things to juggle until we get to the, hey, we're going to take a space shuttle up into space.
Yeah.
But wow, that's what was I doing?
I don't know.
How did I blank out twice? at the same moment.
It must be that virus.
I can't control myself.
The black hell virus. So I took a picture of this thing because you get to see it like once. Mm-hmm. When they first upload the virus into one of the ships. And apparently the pirates have a program that just mixes different like computer viruses together and injects it into whatever sort of computer system. And there's this big old list of viruses. And I just have to read you off a couple of these names.
Okay.
Antichrist. Attention. That's with an exclamation point. Bad Boy, Best Wishes, Disc Killer, Doom 2 / Beta, 8 Tunes, Evil, Holland Girl 2, Horse Boot, let's see, Icelandic 2, Icelandic 3, Leprosy 3, no Leprosy 2, Marty Bros, and Microbes. It's just
Marty Bros.
Yeah.
I mean, here are some real ones in comparison. Like, they're not. I'm curious who. I don't know who names viruses, the creator or the victim.
Mm-hmm.
I love you. All one word. These are all one word.
I think the I love you virus came from the email that you would get. It just says like I love you in it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, thankfully avoided it, but...
I remember we used to worry about, like, a single computer virus?
Yeah, I mean, now it, like, it, at least as far as spam, the idea is, it's like, the most annoying thing is, well, now, they know that this email account is active, and they're just going to keep sending me stuff.
Mm.
What are some... My Doom... Crypto Locker, Stuxnet, STUXnet,
okay.
Conficker, CONFICKER. I wanted to be very careful in saying that. Melissa, WannaCry Ransomware Attack, The Morris Worm, Code Red, Anna Kournikova, which was probably again. Nope, it just sends me to her. It doesn't send me to the virus when I right click on it.
Okay, hold on.
Okay.
The Morris Worm. Have you seen the display at MIT? I think it's MIT.
I'm looking at it right now.
The Computer History Museum. It is one of my favorite things is the Morris Worm display. Where it is just a fucking floppy disk inside of like a plexiglass case with like a placard that tells you about it. But it is just the most like arcane artifact sort of thing. Like I grew up using like floppy disks and CDs and things like that in my computer, or in like the family computer more accurately.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing one of these items in a display as if it were some ancient artifact is just this kind of mind-blowing aesthetic display that I absolutely love.
It's also the signifier here is also the danger of it.
Mm-hmm.
As if, like, don't get too close or yes. It'll get out.
Yes, exactly. It has this very sort of control the video game
sort of
thing to it, where it's just this banal, like, office supply kind of thing is also this super dangerous item that we have to keep under wraps. It's so good. I love it to death.
It's within computer science, it is interesting how there's, like you said, the ordinary average thing that can be the cause of so much trouble. There's in the movie Pi, I think Darren Aronofsky's first film about paranoia and like also this computer scientist. He's trying to find the pattern of the stock market, but like ends up finding the God pattern anyway.
Mm-hmm.
A brokerage firm, i.e. the government, is trying to get him on their side. And their peace offering is like, well, here's a new processor for your system. And it's like this little black square cube, which again, like everyone kind of knows what a processor looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little square. And I remember on the director's commentary where he's like, I wanted that to like be simple. And he's like, I knew people were either going to be in awe that like that little thing had so much power, or they're going to laugh. He was like, what, that little thing? That's the big bribe that, you know, gets the protagonist to get in bed with a brokerage firm / the government.
Right.
Just the non-spectacular nature.
Yes.
Of computing. We haven't really talked much about the episode, which I don't think is bad.
It's fairly straightforward, I think.
It's not like you learn a bunch about Spike. You know?
No. I do think you get to see that Spike has developed like a relationship with somebody that you don't ever really get to see outside of this one episode. Like him and Doohan seem to have this past. Like the swordfish was Doohan's old mono racer, and he gave it to Spike at some point, and then Spike has been using it since, and he brings it back to him periodically to get it like tuned up and checked out and everything. And Spike has been around Doohan enough to recognize that he has chased off multiple like assistants and like understudies, and to see him like work on like getting the Columbia shuttle up and running and all this other stuff. So you get a little bit of, it's not like any real major part of Spike's past, but you do get a little bit of, here is somebody who he has met and become friends with, or at least, you know, acquaintances with, over a period of time. Like, we don't know if he's known him before he left like the Triad, or if it was after, if he's somebody he ran into on Earth at some point, like what that whole situation is. We just have that little bit that, hey, Spike knows this guy. This is where Spike got his ship from. And this is the guy who he trusts to get his ship fixed up when, you know, he can't do it. And I think that's definitely like a nice, neat little, just like a little note to his character. And we get Spike also talking about how he's not exactly a subtle or delicate person, which I think we've definitely come to realize watching the show. But he is also self-aware enough to recognize that.
We also get the very, I guess, memeable quote from Spike of whatever happens, happens, which he says multiple times
mm-hmm.
in the episode. So we do get, I guess, a reiteration of, you know, going with the flow, being like water,
mm-hmm.
letting things happen as they occur. I do like the the teenager's photo collage that we get to see of mm-hmm. Doohan's, which in a lot of the pictures there are modern for our time or modern for the 90s pictures of people next to aircrafts, like
mm-hmm.
Military aircrafts. And it begs the question of like, how old is Doohan again?
Yeah.
Because he could, realistically, he could be like 90 if he was born in, if he was born yeah. like 80 something. It would really make sense if he was born, you know, 80s. That way he gets the nostalgia bump of the shuttle program. So of course he would try to, you know, have that as a hobby of like, let me restore this old gal.
Yeah.
That would put him in the if he was in the military, that would put him in the military in the early 2000s. I mean, it's not unbelievable that he would be 90. I don't think.
Yeah, definitely. Like I could totally see it, at least, you know, or maybe, you know, 80s, somewhere in that range. But yes, no, I could definitely see that. I could definitely see him. I mean, he's stuck on Earth, or at least seemingly so.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Earth is kind of like a bit of a hellscape with all the debris coming from the moon and the gate incident and all that. And, you know, that's where all of these old planes and stuff like that are going to be. You're not going to take, you know, a... Okay, I shouldn't say that because I think that does actually happen in the movie. I think there are like a couple of like biplanes in the film. But, you know, for the most part, you're not going to pack up all of these old like fighter jets and helicopters and things like that and ship them off planet. Like, they're just going to stay there unless you're a collector or want it for like a very particular reason. Doohan probably, you know, grew up before the gate incident with, you know, flying and things like that. And then post gate incident, he seems like the kind of person that would want to stay with all of his stuff or stay with all of the, you know, the things that bring him some sort of satisfaction. So working on planes and being a mechanic and, you know, wanting to rebuild that space shuttle. Yeah.
Like, Duhan's definitely a millennial.
More than likely, yes.
It is weird. Every now and again, I'm reminded of how like close the time period of Cowboy Bebop is.
Oh, yeah.
Very close. I could, my goal is to make it to 2071. Just so I can say it. Cool. Just so I can say I made it to Cowboy Bebop times and then I'm done. I'm out.
Sure, whatever, Grandpa. Let's get you back inside.
It's like, what are you talking about? That crappy live action show?
Oh, no.
No. I think maybe the last big space reference comes, and I have to mention it just because the story behind it rules. So Spike, as he's trying to control his descent, trying not to burn up, he marks the degrees on the glass of the swordfish, and that is supposedly inspired by astronaut Gordon Cooper, who was the astronaut on the last mission of the Mercury program, Mercury Atlas 9, on 1963. So yeah, so there were problems with the entry. Again, very similar to what happened to Spike. He lost all altitude readings, and on the next orbit, they realized that there was a short circuit in the whatever the bus bar serving the 250-volt main inverter was, which just meant that automatic stabilization and control systems did not have electric power. So what this dude did is that he did the same thing. He drew degree lines on the window to help him steer, and then he mapped it to constellations in the sky, or in space, to help him with the getting the right angle. He used his wristwatch to time the burns of engines. And then he just said he straight up used his eyeballs to maintain altitude. So how much do we rely on our GPS, on Google Maps or Waze? I don't know what you use, but like, cool. I guess I have to manually bring this tin can down from space using math and my peepers. Like, damn.
Yeah, I cannot imagine. Like, I know flying an airplane is already hard enough. I've listened to a lot of people that I follow online talk about trying to get a pilot's license and things like that, and it's very, you have to spend a lot of time in a plane. You have to do a lot of like manual navigation and control of your vehicle, which is usually like, you know, some rinky dink like Cessna or something like that. And then having to do that with a space vehicle without any like instruments, with like some scratches on a window and a watch is, oh my God, that is mind blowing.
And it's the fact that it's like, at least in an airplane, it's like, well, my engine went out. Well, that's not the worst thing to happen.
Yeah.
Like, as me as a person, if you tell me an engine goes out on a plane, I'm like, well, we're dead, right? And that's technically not terrible because you're still, it's like, we got wings, man. It's doable.
This plane just turned into a glider. We'll be, we'll probably be okay.
Where this is like, you're not falling into Earth. i.e. you're going to get slingshot into space, bud. You got to figure something out.
Yeah, yeah.
Getting references based on a government program from a different country from over 30 years ago. Good night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, it just shows like the amount of care and research they put into this show for even like the littlest kind of, I mean, it's part of me wants to like knee jerk and call it a reference, but I mean, it's, I don't really think of it. Or at least I don't think that's what they were thinking of. I think they were just thinking of, oh, we have this moment and here's this thing that we learned about. Let's just kind of, you know, emulate it for the most part. But I don't think it's supposed to be an explicit call out. Oh, here's this thing that Gordon Cooper did in 1963. Mm-hmm. It's just, oh, Spike's ship is out. Like his navigation systems are out and he's got to like manually put his ship into, you know, through the atmosphere. Here's this thing that we learned about to, you know, help manually do that. Here's this thing that this one guy did. And yeah, let's kind of put this in here to kind of take up some time.
No, yeah, yeah. I think it's almost, here's a similar situation.
Yeah. I'm still so blown away that let me just use my watch and some scratches to land a spaceship.
We got to the moon on slide rulers, you know?
It's absolutely crazy.
Man, yeah. Space rules. Space travel is cool.
I do want to say that I really like the scene where Duhan is talking to his parts dealer and Spike is talking to Jet and Faye, and where they start going back and forth when they come to a delivery truck and then they both look at each other. I thought that was a really good scene. I like the way that it kind of cuts back and forth as they're coming to like the same conclusion.
Yeah, that was a very nice.
Yeah.
Here's an elegant way to merge A plot and B plot together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I thought that was really, really good. Animation wise, I think there's a lot of good faces, a lot of good facial expressions this episode.
It's fun to realize where you have Faye, who is this, again, original intent, femme fatale. Here's the eye candy. Here's the dangerous woman. And as we're going through, I'm like, oh, she's getting all the good face animation.
Yes.
Like, she stops the wrong delivery truck. She thinks it's the hackers. And they're like, we're sorry. We'll pay the parking fine. And it's just her being so annoyed in a single eyebrow twitch.
Yes. She has some of the, like, just throughout the entire series, she just has some of the best, like, facial expressions, the best sort of like, oh God, this is what I'm dealing with kind of moments. And then Spike this episode has the magical hanging cigarette.
When I smoked.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wouldn't do it because of that, but Ray Stantz and Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
I think when you first see Slimer, he gets that little bit where it just hangs off the lip. It's not that we were trying to do that, but we are always like, hey, when it happened.
Doesn't it happen in Pulp Fiction too?
I want to say yes. It's a very good way of showing surprise.
Yeah. Just having that cigarette just hang there. Mm-hmm. Like they're talking, their mouth is moving and the cigarette is just kind of bouncing around. It's so good. The little photograph at the very end of the episode is nice.
Because they've gone through so much in the episode, especially in that span of the last few minutes. Mm-hmm. It's a nice thing to be like, we already did the thing. You know, we did the danger. You know, we were on we went all the way to the edge. We can't just keep going through. But like, we got to let them know it's fine.
Yeah. I like the fact that it's Miles who is freaking out the entire time there. On re-entry, and then the photograph, he's the one who's up and chipper, like giving the thumbs up, while Spike and Duhan are absolutely exhausted.
Just like, we don't want to pose. One, why'd you bring the camera? Two.
Yeah. Who took that photo?
I'm going to assume either the dude that owned the shop that delivered the part or Timer.
Yeah, probably.
You brought a tripod and a camera up to space. again, this is a very NASA, you know, history of spaceflight sort of episode. And there are a lot of movies that talk about it or explore it. We could talk about The Right Stuff. We could talk about Apollo 13. You know, more recently, Hidden Figures or Gravity. But no, what we're going to talk about is Space Camp from 1986. Now, from your reaction, are you familiar with this movie?
I am familiar. I don't know if I've ever actually seen it like 100%.
Okay.
But well, I am familiar with the movie. Yes.
Okay. Let's get into it. It's directed by Harry Weiner, which was their feature directorial debut. I think they mainly do TV. Like, I think they did some Buffy episodes. Mm. It was written by Clifford Green and Casey T. Mitchell, who were not. They did some things. Those aren't the main attractions to this project. We got to talk about the big ensemble cast.
Hey, Aaron, who's in this movie?
Who is it indeed? Kate Capshaw, who you probably the most famous for playing Willie Scott in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Okay.
The club singer, who. Not coincidentally, is Steven Spielberg's wife, I believe, girlfriend at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of unnecessary hate towards her and Temple of Doom. I think Temple of Doom's fun.
Yeah.
But I'm of a certain age. I also haven't seen it in 20 years, so who knows? Terry O'Quinn is in this movie, who played Locke in the TV series Lost.
Mm-hmm. He was also... Howard Hughes in The Rocketeer.
Yes, that's right. Tom Skerritt, who is best known as playing Dallas from Alien.
Mm-hmm.
We have Leah Thompson, who played Lorraine, or Marty McFly's mom, in the Back to the Future film. It's probably her most famous role. And I don't know who else. Just Academy Award winner Joaquin motherfucking Phoenix. Before it became just a dude,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just a guy in a society, if you will,
credited as Leaf Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, what is Space Camp about? So, it centers around teens attending the titular Space Camp, which is based on the actual one in Huntsville, Alabama. And they are accidentally sent into space by a robot. This is not a lie. In this movie, mm-hmm. One of the crew members, he's like a kid genius. He gets to go to space camp a little bit early. He befriends, just a robot they have hanging out at space camp. And the robot's like, oh, my friend wants to go into space. Let me help. And so, you know, they get launched into space and they have to find their way back home. Or they have to figure out how to get back and land. This movie had some trouble. It was the last film made by ABC Motion Pictures, which was a subsidiary. Leah Thompson has talked about this film. She said when she said on her first day of shooting, they were 10 days behind schedule on what was supposed to be a 3-month shoot. And that turned into a 6-month shoot. She says that they had t-shirts printed up. They said space. I don't know if they had both of these or if she missed. They probably did. Anyway, one shirt supposedly said Space Camp. It's not just a movie. It's a career. and another one just said Space Cramp. Ha ha. The movie did not do well in the box office and like it should have. We've talked about exploitation films, mm-hmm. where you take a popular thing, make a movie about it real quick to bank on it. You know, this was definitely that sort of movie, but unfortunately for a lot of reasons, it came out 5 months after the Challenger accident. So on a budget of anywhere from 18 to 25 million, depending on who you ask, I guess the box office was only 10 million.
Mm.
That a lot of things going against it. And I've looked at some clips recently and they had a lot of the movie is them in the shuttle in space trying to figure out like, well, we have to fix this so we can come back. The effects ain't half bad, man. They're yeah. still pretty, like, you kind of believe they're floating up around. Like, little Aaron was very, like, how do they do this? Do they actually go to space to shoot this? Mm. and that's part of the, one, it's a little trolly to mention this movie. But again, talking about this episode just brought back all these, feelings about, you know, being so enamored and fascinated with space travel. Like, this man, this movie got played a lot in the old VCR in the Shelton household. It was made in the 80s. I haven't watched it in a long time, so I can't say whether or not it has aged well. It's not currently streaming anywhere. Like, I don't even think you can. Let me double check. Space Camp. And Space Camp is one word for some reason.
Oh, yeah, it's intercapped.
Yeah.
For some reason.
It's available to purchase legally. It's not streaming anywhere, but I don't know. If you search maybe a website that begins with Y, you might be able to find it if that's your bag. If you don't want to spend $20 on a one-time experience. I get it. But do not fret, because they remake everything, baby.
I was just about to bring this part up.
You want to take it? Go for it.
So in January of this year, 2020, with the acquisition of 20th Century Fox by Disney, they announced that for Disney Plus, they were going to make a remake of Space Camp.
Yeah. The attached writers as of now are Mikey Day, who's the cast member on SNL, and Streeter Seidel, who was an original cast member on College Humor. So you can kind of guess what direction they're going to take. I hope the robot comes back.
Frank Welker's still around. He can come back. And
yeah, of course. He boots it. It's a gritty reboot. Maybe they just spoof Interstellar and it's just about a bunch of wormholes.
Probably.
Who knows? Little Aaron liked it, so whatever that means. Space Camp 1986. Space rules. Learn more about it. I don't know what the admonishment is.
So I have a recommendation that is not a movie, but is in fact a video game. If you want to learn the crazy bonkers intricacies of getting a spaceship into space and having it do its job, I'm going to recommend the video game Kerbal Space Program. It is a sim where you are trying to get your little boys and girls, the Kerbals, off of their planet and into space. And it is an incredibly accurate space simulator. And you can build your own crazy, wacky looking spaceship that will probably not work. But you can build spaceships and send them up and try and see what you can and can't get working. You have an entire full solar system that you can explore. So you can go to the moons of planet Kerbal and out to their Venus and Mars and Pluto. It is a mind-blowing kind of game, the level of details. And you get to learn all about orbit patterns, and I've watched a lot of playthrough of this game. There's a feature on giantbomb.com called Project Beast, where they try and get a Kerbal to the moon and back, and it is it's hilarious. I'm going to tell you that right now, because these people have no idea how any of this stuff actually works. But watching them play it, watching some other people play it, how you get out into space involves a lot of circles. So you're basically, you try and launch it to orbit, and then orbit is just basically moving fast enough around a planet that you don't go down, because you're constantly getting pulled down onto a planet. And then using that orbit to go fast enough that you slingshot yourself out towards another object, and you time it just so that you hope the gravity of that other object grabs you, or else you go flying off into the dark abyss of space. it's utterly fascinating. And if you want to get a better understanding of how, like, space shuttles and space programs work, I would highly recommend it. I think there's actually a Kerbal Space Program 2 on the way.
Mm.
But given, you know, the year that we have had, it is probably on delay, or it's going to be a while before that actually comes out. But Kerbal Space Program 1 is on Steam. It's on your PC. Go check it out.
I'm curious if, like, an actual person from NASA was like, all right, let me speed run this bad boy.
I've seen some videos, like, so in the Project Beast feature, they fuck up a lot. And they have, at one point, they have two or three Kerbals in, like, little capsules floating out into the abyss of space. And they get I forget what his name is, but they get, like, a guy who's actually, like, knows all about, like, astrophysics and things like that to download their save and go and rescue these Kerbals that they've got flying out in space. And he does it in maybe, like, 2 hours when it takes the main members of the Project Beast team, like, a couple days to do it. It's great. If you get somebody who actually knows how all of this stuff is supposed to work, they can do some magic with that game. It's great.
Oh, that's awesome. And it's awesome that all of you have listened and spent some time with us. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much. If you want to talk to us, let us know how we're doing. Let us know if there's anything we missed, or maybe there's a topic that you wanted us to discuss. You can do so by writing to us at thinkingtoohardpod@gmail.com. You can also contact us on Twitter at thinkinganime. You can find me on Twitter. That's mainly where I hang out. I'm at Aaron J. Shelton. I also do another podcast with my co-host Vince White called Kame House Party. We are attempting to go through every episode of Dragon Ball, and we do improv along the way, as well as streaming every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, a variety of games. And you can find us at twitch.tv/Kame House Party. Noah, where can the good people find you?
Yes, that's me. I'm Noah. So you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kamen Otaku. That's KamenOtaku. If you want to see me get mad about the world, you can follow me there. And then you can also check me out on a couple other podcasts, like the Role Playing Exchange, Technical Difficulties Gaming Podcast, and I'm on the Best Power Gauge stream on Saturdays.
And we'll be back in 3 weeks this time. We're taking a break for American Thanksgiving with Session 20, which Noah's going to say.
Session 20, Pierrot Le Fou.
Thank you. But as always, I'm Aaron.
I'm Noah.
And we've been thinking too hard.